You're listening to a rebroadcast of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
All right, first to Central California and Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Lear, welcome.
Nice to be here with you, Art.
Are you keeping your head above water?
I think so. We've had a beautiful day today and a chance to dry up and have all the excess seep its way back into the sea.
All right. If you would not mind, I did not retain your bio, so if you would fill the audience in a little bit on your background, it would be helpful.
Well, it's quite simple, Art. I've been in private practice as a podiatric surgeon for about 33 years. I've had, since childhood, an interest in ufology. I remember my father walking into the kitchen that interesting day in 1947 and throwing a newspaper down on the table and reading the headline to my mother about the U.S. Air Force capturing a flying disc. He expounded on that to such a great extent, I guess it left a permanent impression on my mind. And I have been a private pilot for a number of years. I have 1,700 hours collected in both multi-engine and single-engine aircraft. I was IFR rated. It's instrument flight rated.
A lot of doctors fly, don't they?
Yes, they do. I was with a group called the Flying Physicians, and it gave me an opportunity to go down into some less fortunate areas, such as Mexico, and give some medical care down there. It's a real nice duty.
When did you encounter your first implant, doctor?
The first set of surgeries, Art, was done on August the 19th of 1995. And we did two cases, one male, one female. A female, two apparent objects in the big toe of the left foot, and a male patient who had an object in the back of the left hand. And as long as you brought out the subject of the bio, I'd like to get some facts just crystal clear to the audience so they really understand where I'm coming from personally.
All right.
What I am and what I am not. I do surgery on the foot. I do not do surgery in other areas of the body. But it being in practice for as long as I have colleagues in the other specialties. So when they say that First has performed surgery on a hand or a head or a foot or whatever, I may participate in actually doing the surgery on the foot, or I may assist or be present at the other surgeries. I'm the one that set up the team. I put the whole thing together, so to speak, and each does his part. And it's all volunteer work. No one charges a dime for their services. Also, what I am and what I am not, I am a collector of what we believe is physical evidence that seems to be leading to the fact that people who allege abduction experiences, a few of them or some of them, have objects in their body which so far looks like, after some severe analysis, that they may have extraterrestrial origins. What I am not is a person who has a multiplicity of fields of expertise. I am not a physicist. I am not a metallurgist. So when I interpret metallurgical micrographs, I'm doing that because I'm essentially have the material in front of me that other scientists have put forth. And in the realm that is now is where it belongs. What Daryl and I have been trying to do is to really mate hard science to the field of ufology.
Well, it sure does need it. Before we get to Daryl, and I'm about to bring Daryl on and ask him a bit about himself, there is something that you told me on the phone earlier that is really shocking, and I thought I'd let you pass that on to the audience.
I just can't imagine what that could be. As you probably realize, the organization that we formed, the Fund for Interactive Research in Space Technology, through the years now is receiving information from various sources on really all aspects of the UFO phenomena. But today, I got an interesting personal call this morning from a lady that I've known for many, many years. And she has a significant other who works in the aerospace industry. I have known that. I've never really quizzed her as to what firm he works for or what he does.
Sure.
Being the section director for MUFON, Ventura, Santa Barbara Counties, I'm present at all the meetings, and these folks have been invited several times and came, and I listened to the comments that their significant other would make going out the door, kind of making remarks like, oh, you guys are kind of strange, and just show me an ET and I'll shake hands with them.
Shaking their heads.
Right. Yep. And, yeah. A real doubting Thomas. And I had fun. I enjoyed the evening. Thanks for inviting me. Bye-bye.
Sure.
Well, this morning, she tells me, the fella came home last night and his face was as red as a beet. And he was just, beside himself. So she says, I asked him, what's going on? What's happening? So he began to tell her the story of what was going on at work. Now, I find this morning that he is a quality assurance control inspector in the aerospace industry, but his check does not come from any one of the aerospace companies. He is employed by the DOD.
Department of Defense.
And what seems to be the problem, as he explains to my friend, he is in danger of losing his job because the entity that he was working on was Skylab, and particularly the solar panels.
The Skylab solar panels, that would be for our new space station.
That's correct. That was his job. He's assurance quality control for the DOD, and his job was to work with particularly the solar panels for this particular entity.
Uh-huh.
So she said, well, what's going on? What's happening? What's got you so irritated? He says, well, I may not only lose my job on this particular item, but he says my hours can be greatly reduced. And he had extreme monetary concerns because they just found out last night that NASA canceled the contract for the Skylab.
My God.
And so she said to him, well, my gosh, why did they do that? Are they cutting back on the budget or whatever? And she said, and I haven't told you this, Art, that he pointed to the ceiling and says, because of them. And she said,
oh, my.
Who's them? And he said, I don't know who in the heck or what they are, but they told us to stay out of space. So they've canceled, according to what she told me this morning, they canceled the contracts for Moon, Mars missions, and the Skylab, because the Skylab was supposed to be a stepping stone where we could launch inexpensive manned spaceflight.
All right, I can fill you in a little bit. There was a memo on January 9th which canceled all manned missions to the Moon or Mars. Period. I mean, it flat canceled them. In the last couple of days, after a big controversy, Daniel Golden, NASA administrator, reversed the whole thing, but without giving any details of any missions that are planned or budgeted. So, in other words, there actually was a memo that went out, said the whole thing's being canceled, and the political flak hit the fan. Golden reversed it. But now what you're saying is almost like another source, and we're canceling the space station?
Yeah, here's a totally different source. And, of course, I heard the same thing that you had heard. In fact, we had talked about this brief, and I thought, perhaps there was some kind of budget cutting going on. If they were canceling the contracts, they just were probably going to have them do new ones, maybe to save money or something. But now it's totally in independent source with all the emotion involved. And as I said, a guy who came to MUFON meetings and would chuckle and laugh, you know, about the things we were talking about.
He's not laughing now.
He's not laughing now and is an apparent victim of what's going on.
And again, the real kicker is, when asked why, he pointed up and said, because of them?
That's right. And he told her, he says, I don't know who in the heck they are, but they have told us not to go back into space.
All right, let us bring on with us Daryl Sims. Daryl, welcome to the program.
Hello, Art.
Hi, where are you, Daryl?
I'm in Houston, Texas.
Houston, all right. Gee, NASA country, huh?
Yes.
What do you,
down the road.
Were you aware of what Dr. Lear was going to say?
As a matter of fact, I was, and I've tried to get a confirmation or a denial one way or the other from some people in NASA that I know that would be able to validate that or not, and I was not able to, for some strange reason, was not able to get in touch with the people tonight.
Nobody answering phones.
I just, email or anything. I was real surprised by that because normally they would answer within an hour or two at the latest.
Daryl, if you would give us a little bit of your own background. Have I ever interviewed you, Daryl?
Certainly you have. In fact, you gave me a compliment one time that I framed. I'm the investigator that you interviewed several years ago, and I did a post-hypnotic suggestion on one of the abductees we had with their permission, and it got a reaction from the alien presence. And in fact, they reacted in such a way that they abducted eight of our people, including my senior investigator.
Oh, my.
It became a very famous case, and we ended up getting an ocular implant out of the deal, and an absolutely incredible set of cases. It's the first time that I know of that there seems to be a reaction by them to something we may have done. But basically, I'm the Dr. Lear, of course, is the medical director of FIRST, and I'm the director of physical evidence. And my primary work in FIRST is a hypnotic anesthesiologist, and I bring to the table over 27 years of investigative experience. I used to be in the Central Intelligence Agency for 2 years in covert ops during the Vietnam War. I was not in Vietnam, I was in country. And the second thing is that I was also a senior military police officer, and have a host of other skills that I bring into the investigative arena. I'm master-level NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. I'm a hypnotic anesthesiologist by trade, master hypnotherapist. That means I teach and certify people in hypnotherapy, and also have special certifications in medical hypnotherapy in specialized areas.
Okay, Daryl, you know, the moment you say CIA, red flags go up all over the place.
Oh, of course. And the reason that they should go up, and anyone that's been connected with any of the intelligence communities that's in UFO investigations certainly should be looked at, in my view. I didn't have to tell anybody that years ago, nearly, I guess, close to 15 years ago, I didn't have to tell anybody that at all. No one would have been the wiser. I felt like it was important to divulge your background. Militarily and intelligence-wise, for two primary reasons. One is it's just good policy to, for people to know where people are at or where they've been, and number two, it's very important, I think, that people, if they know you've been in the intelligence community, it's real difficult for someone to think that you're spying on them if, in fact, you told them that's what you used to be involved with.
That's right.
So that would be one of the most bizarre things I can imagine, telling somebody that you were in something like that, and then that you're it tends to alleviate a lot of fears with some people.
How did you and Dr. Roger Lear connect?
Oh, this was a very interesting story, and I'll be brief. I was presenting at a conference in Southern California, and in Los Angeles, and during this time, a lady came by, looked at some of the physical evidence I had, x-rays and other things, and she and Roger were together there from Ventura MUFON, and they looked over the material, and Roger said, well, those look like surgical clips in that lady's feet. Why don't you have them removed? And I said, well, they're not surgical clips, and they appear to be some type of implantation. And he looked over the situation, and as Roger will state and has stated publicly many times on TV and other places, he's the consummate skeptic. He is in the scientific realm of things, so to speak. And so his point was to, well, okay, let's remove the objects and get rid of them, and that'll be it. Of course, the events that ensued after that, whenever we first lined these people up for surgery, I called Roger and told him, I said, I have to tell you two things, or no one's ever going to believe this in the history of this entire business. He said, what's that? I said, well, number one, if these in fact are implants and they're alien related, you're going to find no signs of inflammatory response, either chronic or acute. And he laughed. He said, well, I can assure you that that's not going to happen.
No rejection reaction?
None whatsoever. I said, you will not find that if this is what this material is. Number two, you're going to find nerve cells around surrounding the objects, and the wrong kind in a lot of them. And he kind of giggled and said, well, okay. And
those would be, for the layman, neural connection points, in effect?
Yes, they had nerve proprioceptors surrounding the alleged implants. After the pathology reports came back, he called me several times that day and finally got me at 11:30 at night and says, you're not going to believe what the path report says. And I said, I'll bet I do. And he said, no signs of inflammatory response, either chronic or acute. And he said, that's from two different pathologists. Unknown, they have no idea what it is they're looking at. It's just tissue.
Is that physically possible, doctor?
Well, let's say in the 33 years of removing things from the human body, and I've removed a lot of them, as you can well imagine, because people step on all sorts, everything from coral to metal to paper to whatever. When you get a path report back, you always find that there's some kind of an inflammatory response, either acute or chronic. And I might point out that some pseudo-scientific authorities think that once something has been in the body for many years, such as during one of our wars, or some of the wars, I should say.
Piece of shrapnel.
Shrapnel or splatter effect, and people get pelted with stuff, and if it's too dangerous to stay, to take out, it's left in there, and then people get along okay. But at any time, if you biopsy these or you remove them, you would see evidence of a chronic inflammatory reaction.
In other words, the body always rejects in some way or shows signs of rejection of foreign objects.
That's correct.
Non-biological objects.
That's correct. If it doesn't belong there, the body recognizes it, and if it can't get rid of it, then it just walls it off.
All right. Good enough. Both of you hold on. We'll be right back. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guests are Dr. Roger Lear and Daryl Sims from Houston, ex-CIA and more. The implant pictures are on the website. Go take a look right now. I'm Art Bell.
Cassette tape of this Art Bell Encore presentation is available by calling 1-800-917-4278. Please specify the date you heard this broadcast. That's 1-800-917-4278.
Back now to my guest, Dr. Lear. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
And Daryl Sims.
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Lear, again, you're saying that anything that would be alien to the human body, even for years and years in place, would continue to show a rejection reaction of some sort.
Absolutely. There's just deal in the realm of impossibility to think that the human body would not reject something as foreign to it. Now, even our own tissues, under certain circumstances, are ejected. And as you know, if you bleed into your tissues, even under the skin, you know what happens. You get a terrible inflammatory reaction and a lot of pain.
That's right.
And this can happen in the mouth or in the eyeball or any place else. So our own blood, once it's coagulated, acts as a foreign body. So that's just an example of how sensitive the body is to things that don't belong there.
Well then, if you were to determine what factor in these implants utterly prevents any rejection, you would have made a gigantic medical leap forward, wouldn't you?
You bet your bippy, Art. it would be a sensational advance in the medical technology.
So then these should be not just taken out and examined the way you have here, but they should be studied by the larger medical community for obvious reasons.
That's correct. That's why we certainly don't throw anything away. We think that perhaps one of the reasons that this is going on is that the membrane, which covers these the metallurgy, so to speak, is responsible for stopping the rejection reaction.
A membrane?
Yes, there's a very dark gray, smooth membrane that covers the objects, and you can't cut through it with a surgical blade. Kind of an extraordinary piece of soft tissue.
That's quite remarkable. That membrane, would you imagine it to have been there from the moment of implantation, or would you imagine it to have, in effect, grown there?
Well, you know, you can do a lot of guesswork, but it's really quite unscientific to do that. So if you're going to stay within the realms of science, you can put forth the theory and then take it into a lab and either prove it or disprove it. Let's say that the implant is put in with this membrane around it.
Right.
Let's say possibly it could be a form of a gelatinous mass which then congeals over the object, and then all of these areas have no portal of entry. There's no scar. There's no there's not even a pore out of place.
This is the end of side one. Please leave the cassette exactly where it is, flip it over, and begin again.
To the best of Art Bell.
How would it be possible to have something so strong in the form of a membrane that a scalpel would not go through it?
Well, I have some ideas about that, too. I also wanted to mention that we have a couple of major drug companies that are looking at this with a lot of interest because of the simplicity. And I can tell you and your audience right now what it's made of because we've already had the analysis done.
I'll bite.
Just very simply, only three things. Three things, all which come from the body. One is called a protein coagulum, which is just a fancy way of saying it's made from blood, the proteins of blood.
Okay.
Then if you picture that as you would like a bowl of Jell-O, clear Jell-O, we'll add a few things to it. One is we'll add some dark brown granules, and this is an iron stain, which is a cousin to the iron stain that's in your red cells called hemoglobin. And in this instance, it's called hemosiderin. It's an oxygen-binding iron pigment.
All right.
And in the red cell, this is what happens. It binds with oxygen, and the cell travels around your body, gives up its oxygen, takes on carbon dioxide, winds up back into the lung, and gives that up. So it's a transport mechanism. Well, its cousin, hemosiderin, does a similar thing. So it has hemosiderin in it. And then there's some striae, or strands, to make it quite simple. So you look at the Jell-O with these brown granules in it, like raisins, and then we add something that looks like coconut, and that's the striae, or the strands, and the strands are made of keratin. And I'm sure that every single female that's listening out there knows what keratin is. So they spend, it's $1 billion or more industry. People taking care of their keratin, because it's the outer layer of your skin. Makes up a few layers of the cornea of your eye, your fingernails, your hair.
Okay.
So those are the only three things that make up this membrane. Now, what gives it this tremendous tensile strength? I didn't really understand this until I discussed this with a couple of folks that you probably know, David Adair and Colonel Corso.
Oh, yes.
And talking to Phil Corso about these fibers where the molecules line up, tremendous tensile strength, and he pointed out a spider web is, of course, one of the most basic biological entities that have these super tenacity fibers. So maybe we have something the same here. We haven't gone to that extent of electron microscopy yet.
All right. Have you found this same fibrous material over other foreign bodies that you've removed over the years?
Never.
Never.
A surgical blade is sharp, and you can whittle a bone with it either inadvertently or on purpose, but to not be able to cut through a piece of soft tissue is very strange indeed. The general surgeon that I was working with is also a 30-some-odd-year veteran of doing surgery all over the body, and he looked at this thing and said, well, I don't get it. But, you know, Daryl took the specimens back to Texas with him, and I'll let him tell you that portion of it.
All right, but let's back up a little bit and have Daryl tell us about the people from whom these specimens came, or as much as you're able to tell us, Daryl.
Sure. The first individual, a lady, was watching me on a program in 1991. On an Access TV program, and after she watched the program, she called me and set up an appointment to speak with me concerning alleged alien abduction. And after I met with her, I said, well, what would convince me of that you were abducted? And she said, well, I have all these memories. There were other witnesses, my two children, my husband, and so on. And I said, okay. I said, well, I primarily deal in physical evidence. Do you have anything? She said, yes. She showed me some x-rays of her feet and three objects, one of them in a T formation, very unusual, and I said, well, it looks like you stepped on a pin, it broke, it migrated, and there it is. And she said, I thought you'd say that. She was kind of waiting on me. And then she handed me her medical report, which stated by her doctor that these objects were surgically installed due to previous surgery. Well, that kind of sunk my boat.
Wait a minute. That they had been surgically installed at some previous surgery.
That's correct. And there was no history of previous surgery on her medical record, nor from the parents and others that I interviewed.
Okay.
So this got my attention, and I held this case for about 3 years working with her. And then I met a gentleman through my senior investigator, Dale Musser. And the gentleman's name is Pat Pernello. And we went down and interviewed him. And he told me about an interesting object in his hand and so on, and he had gotten an x-ray for us as we'd requested. And after we looked at the x-ray for a while and talked to him for a while, listened to his stories, a remarkable man, a rather amusing thing happened. I pull out another x-ray of an object looked almost identical to his, the lady's feet. He was a little concerned.
So that was a lady?
That was, yes. Pat Pernello, the man who had an object in his
hand.
In his hand as well.
And so you pulled out, you put the x-rays side by side and said, hey.
They were very similar, and he was rather amused. Well, what amazed me about the whole thing is neither of these people have any connection to each other whatsoever.
I'm not sure I'd use the word amused.
I got stunned after a while. What I found later, after the surgeries were over and after the people had given their cases, their histories, and everything was finished, with that end of it, I was rather shocked whenever I started comparing all the data of these two people collectively. Interestingly enough, Mr. Pat Pernello is almost obsessed with a remarkable intertwining of three Moebius strips. That Moebius strip is just like a one-inch wide piece of paper about a foot long. If you glue it together in a circle like a child would, that's just a basic circle. If you put a twist in it, you have a one-sided object.
Yes.
And it's remarkable. What he puts three of them together and does a remarkable a presentation for about 2 hours showing you how to reverse polarities and all kinds of amazing things mathematically with these three intertwining MOGA strips.
Something, no doubt, knowledge acquired during an abduction.
That seems to be the deal. Well, what's amazing about that, and something I had never and have not revealed to either one of the two people, is that he describes three MOGA strip type objects approximately 18 feet tall inside the craft that appear to power it.
Oh, my.
It gets even weirder. There was a ball inside the clear, glass-like MOGA strip figure eight type configurations. It ran through there. The ball was about the size, and each of them was about the size of a basketball. And in his case, he describes when he was about 5 or 6 years old, it's like he switched on. He didn't wake up from a bad dream. He just literally switched on, goes outside. He lives in a farming community at the time. Walks out into a field that's freshly plowed, looks around at the lights flying around the air, the UFOs, and then a little ball about the size of a basketball, glowing, comes down and lands in front of him in slow motion, makes a little puff of dust as it hits the ground. It begins to spin slowly, and he realizes at this point, I probably shouldn't be here. He begins to run away, and he feels like it exploded and blew the object into his hand. I suspect that probably is a screensaver memory, and to explain that very briefly to your audience, a screensaver to me is like something, a screensaver on your computer. If you shake the computer, the screensaver will go off, and you'll get back to the real memory of what's going on.
That's right.
Well, that's the way it is with hypnosis. A lot of times people hypnotize these people, and they're hypnotizing the screen memory. And they think that's actually the memory, and it isn't.
Uh-huh.
It's something that's installed by the beings themselves to keep you from getting to the event of what really they're up to, in my opinion. But anyway, the reason I think that is a screensaver memory in that part of the event is simply because the fact that if the object had exploded, there would be heat, there would be an area of penetration. Dr. Lear and the other surgeon found no place of portal of entry in any of the seven patients we found.
No entry point?
No portal of entry whatsoever. If it had been blown up and gone into his hand there would have been heat.
Obviously.
Which would have caused, obviously, a reaction by the body in form of a scar tissue and everything else.
Doctor, how do you explain that? How could there be no point of entry for any of these objects, no matter how they were inserted?
Well, let's call it, for lack of a better term, a scientific curiosity. but again, as I said, I come from a scientific background, so it's a little bit difficult for me to ponder such things, but when you listen to the story, and I've read most of the books, and
but I mean, this on really is, this is your field of expertise. So I mean, if an object is within somebody, in their foot, wherever, there absolutely must be a point of entry. If this object is a foreign object, alien or otherwise, there's got to be a place where it went in.
Well, to borrow a phrase from John Mack's book, Abduction, I guess we have to deal with alternate realities. If we accept these as truths, then we are dealing with alternate realities. And if there is such a thing as a being who can certainly materialize in your room at night, come through a wall, a ceiling, or solid objects, then I would suppose that it's not really much of a feat to disassociate living matter.
Well, no offense at all to the people who tell the abduction stories, but they're stories, and here we are dealing with physical evidence.
That's right. That's why I said, I have absolutely no scientific explanation, and no one else has either.
Roger, maybe I can toss in something here, not from the science end, but from the abductee's point of view of how some of this may take place. One of the things that Roger found there through the pathologist in these people was, and especially in some of our other surgeries, was some of these people have scoop marks on their shins, back of their legs, different places. These are literally a dermatological punch that's taken from the person. And so according to some of our witnesses in the abduction scenarios, some of these punches are taken out with a little device that makes a little noise, and it seems to have a light on it, and it cauterizes the wound almost instantly. Now, what's interesting about that is in some of the people that we've examined that with these alleged implants that do have scoop marks, two things are very interesting about it. Number one is the thing that was found inside the smooth little indention there, the scoop mark in the leg that was found, we found solar elastosis, which means basically that that area of the body in that little tiny area has been subjected to an enormous amount of ultraviolet radiation.
UV now, radiation?
These people have been, the two ladies in particularly involved, were very light-skinned. They never go outside. It just doesn't make any sense for that to be the case. And what's really amazing to me about the whole thing is that Dr. Lear's findings and the pathologist's findings found that there was a carcinous material surrounding the biological covering surrounding the alleged metal implants that you see on your web page there. There was a biological covering around that that he could not cut through with the surgical scalpel.
So we are seeing, I am not used to looking at a scanning electron microscope photographs, and it might be a moment to ask, we're looking at metallic objects here?
You're looking at a metallic object that once was covered with a dark, dense, gray biological jacket. It surrounded the entire T-shaped formation. And the amazing thing about that is that the keratinous material that was found around that object, that which primarily made up the bulk of the matter there, the biological jacket, that is the same material that's found on the outside of the skin. Now, think of it this way. Just suppose you could take a scoop from someone and then could culture that for any length of time. You could go in there and install an alleged implant with their own material. It would answer the question of where nerve proprioceptors, that's the nerve cells that you have on the outside of the body, how they got inside, deep inside the body, next to the bone.
But this is, you're describing a deliberate, a complex, extremely difficult process.
I think that is what's suggestive here, based on the stories and based on the pathological evidence.
Now, did these two women both have, the woman and the man, did they both have these scoop marks?
No, they don't show the scoop marks. The lady has, but I didn't notice any on Pat. You could take a very small sample from anyone, anywhere, and culture it and have this sort of thing. You wouldn't have to have a scoop mark per se, but many of the abductees, including myself, have them, and the only difference in me is I remember how I got mine when I was 4 years old.
Do we have the ability, Dr. Lear, to duplicate what has just been described? In other words, could you take a foreign body and so code it with the results that that we've just heard?
This would be in the form of an experiment, Art.
Yes, true, I guess so.
That's why these drug companies have such an interest in this, because if this membrane is the, let's say, the protective bio layer between foreign material and the body itself, you could technically duplicate it, wrap a heart or a kidney or anything else in it, and there wouldn't be any use for Imuran or any other cyclosporin or any other of these immunosuppressive drugs that are necessary to keep rejection.
All right, but the point is, we haven't done it yet.
Not that we know of.
All right, and that's a good place to hold it right there. Not that we know of. Coated with our own skin. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? But in implants that have been taken out already? That doesn't make sense. I'm Art Bell.